Hey guys, welcome to this special episode of the Untitled Gadget Podcast. And this time around, we are actually going to be talking about a game that will be releasing this week. And if you've been under a rock, that's called Horizon Forbidden West by Guerrilla Games, and exclusive for the PlayStation consoles. And like last time, as we did for The Last of Us Part 2, I have a special guest with us. And I think you may all know him. His name is Rishi Alwani, former editor of IGN and now doing a lot of things. So please welcome Rishi. How's it going, man?
Hey, more like Untitled Games Podcast, am I right?
Yeah,
thanks for having me, Akshay. So yeah, this is a podcast where we're going to be discussing Horizon Forbidden West. It's a PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5 exclusive, and it should be available from the 18th. The embargo for this lifts on Valentine's Day, Feb 14th, for some cheesy reason. We're here to discuss what to expect. And this is going to be spoiler-free, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, we have to make sure this is spoiler-free because these are the kind of games you don't want to spoil for people, especially if you are talking about the game before release. As Rishi mentioned, the embargo timings, we're recording this a few days early because we finished the game, both of us, of course. But there are a lot of things to talk about this game in general, in terms of the story, the gameplay mechanics, and what the game means for India as well. That's why we have Rishi here, because he seems to know everything about that. But before we get started, I want to get your general opinion of this game, Rishi. How do you think about this, how this game will do, and in your opinion, how the game actually is in general?
So it took me around 26 hours to finish the game. This is on normal difficulty. And to be honest, it's really good. From a point of view of production values are impeccable. Everything from how Aloy animates to even the NPCs and the detail they have. This is really one of those experiences that, it's super immersive in that way. First impressions are like amazing from that perspective. And as you keep playing, you end up unlocking new stories, new side quests, new things to uncover. Because what this game does really well is, if you're already invested in the Horizon universe per se, like if you finished Zero Dawn and if you wanted more of it, this is just that. It's a kind of game that, while we can't spoil certain story elements, I can say that it's the kind of game where if you've played Zero Dawn and if you've played the Frozen Wilds expansion, you're going to be rewarded here. You're going to like it here because this game takes place right after the first one.
I think it's 6 months after the first one.
In canon, yeah, six. But then what's really good is there is, and it rewards you for, if you've stuck around and if you've played Zero Dawn, you're really rewarded by some of the dialogue, some of the callbacks to the first game. So it's really cool from that perspective. And I really like that because it's very rare for a AAA studio to do a sequel that aligns so closely with the first game. And that's because at the end of the day, most studios look at the second game as the one where you get more people in, you get a broader audience. And, the source material should be toned down a bit so that you get the normies in. But what's really nice here is that they took an approach where even if you never played the first game, it's easy to understand because they got a really handy recap. And what they've also done is the way the dialogue works, the way you get to hear more about the lore and the story, it's done in such a way where if you've experienced everything Zero Dawn has to offer, you will realize certain nods, certain Easter eggs, certain references. So I think it's really cool to see a studio care to that degree. And this is coming from someone who's been burnt on, sequels after sequel after sequel, when, it's always been a lot more dumbed down from that perspective. Here it elevates you. Even if you're someone who's never played the first game and you're coming into this, you want to learn more. And I think that's something Guerrilla does expertly.
Yeah, I think I'm just gonna echo what you're saying here, that while the callbacks are there, it also translates into like some of the side stories that you do. There's a particular mission about a rebel camp, which is closely tied to the previous game as well, which is kind of a closure for that story arc. It wasn't a very big story arc in the first game, But you get some closure for that as well in one of the side missions. And I loved how they tied everything together, like from the first game in the second one. And, and that's true for most side quests. In fact, Rishi said it took him 27 hours. I finished the game in about 32 hours because I played a few more side missions because they were so good. I couldn't, I was like, when I was playing the game, like, yeah, today I'm not in the mood to play any of the story missions because I want to savor this as much as I can, and let's do some side missions. And the side missions would be so good. Like the storytelling in side missions are also closely tied with the main plot. Like it's not like a Ubisoft game, right? Where you're like, yeah, go get me this. It's not like that at all. The characters have major dialogue in all these side missions. All like in the previous game, if you saw like side missions, some of the like motion capture was not, well, I don't think they had motion capture for all aspects of the game in the first game, but in this game, even in side quests, like the cutscenes look fucking incredible, and I loved it because that's the kind of attention to detail you want in a game, and Guerrilla Games did a great job for that. But yeah, but as Rishi said, I love this game as well. I think I may be in love with Aloy. That's just it's just me putting it out there. And in general, like I love how she approaches all missions and every story mission, every side mission. She is not apprehensive. She's not this aggressive character that would not understand the ways of different people in this game. And I loved that touch to her. To her personality. So in a way, this game expands on almost every front, be it the lore, be it the gameplay, be it graphics. There are major improvements in the graphics as well. So like overall, I mean, if you want to know how to do a sequel, this is how you do it,
Oh, I
right?
agree. I agree in a large way that this is one of the better examples of a sequel from Guerrilla. Personally, I still, from in terms of doing a sequel, right? Personally, I still feel their work on Killzone 2 is still apex level. But I mean, but
Oh
this
God,
is
yeah.
close. This is close in my opinion. But then again, I'm a bit of a Guerrilla fan anyway, since Killzone days. But that being said, what's interesting here is from a gameplay perspective, the core gameplay mechanics are similar to the first game. So if you like the whole loop of close range spears and then using arrows and then using bolt casters, you'll be right at home. But what's really cool is they've shaken things up a bit with something called the Valor system, where you can unlock special abilities that are really cool to use. Since I played through Critical Path and didn't bother too much with the side stuff, the Valor system essentially, where every time you level up, you get points that you can put towards specific booster bonuses. And I the only one I unlocked through my playthrough, because I was very curious to see how it would work out, and I maxed it out as well, is the Overshield and the health buffs. And I thought those were really cool touches, especially how they tie it in back to the game world and the game story, because an Overshield is a very sci-fi thing. And the game world is still kind of primitive types, even though you have mechanical aspects to it. So that is one part that I really liked. And obviously you have new overrides, new beasts to mount. The enemy design is as good as the first one. You still have Thunderjaws that will kick your ass if you don't know what you're doing. And you have,
Many new beasts that will kick your ass
yeah,
like even more.
yeah, there were some like really cool boss encounters, particularly with one snake-like enemy at the beginning. You fight off against this huge Leviathan, aquatic-like beast called the Tide Ripper, which was really cool
Oof.
too. So the combat and the enemy design is pretty much top-notch. It works on so many levels. At some point in time, some of the combat felt more complex than it should, which I thought was a good thing, because you'll have to you'll if you because if you don't spend time crafting and upgrading your pouches or your ammo packs, you're gonna have to keep swapping between weapons or crafting stuff
All
on
the
the
time.
fly. And I really like the pace of which the combat took place when you're in an encounter, because you're always on your toes. And in some cases, yeah, maybe it's to the game's detriment, but you couldn't exactly, in some encounters, when you're up against, let's say, invisible ravagers, right? Like when you're like going through deep into enemy territory and you find these invisible ravagers just there, scanning them doesn't usually happen in time, and you need to scan them because you know their weaknesses. But otherwise, it was pretty cool from a moment-to-moment gameplay perspective. They didn't shake up the formula too much, so if you're expecting a radically different game, that's not there. But to be fair, I mean,
It didn't need much of
exactly.
changing.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't. You didn't need to rebuild from ground up because what was there was great to begin with. There were some other new additions I liked, like in Traversal, where you could use a grappling hook. And even though I...
Pull cast.
Yeah, the pull cast.
They call it the pull cast.
Yeah, yeah. So they had that. And I really liked the addition of the fact that you can glide. So gliding down was really cool. I thought that was a very Breath of the Wild thing to do. But though it does work in this environment as well. Traversal was fun for most part. Personally, so the game has two modes. You can play in 60, you can play in performance or resolution. Performance puts it close to 60, resolution favors close to 4K or at 4K. I was playing on a monitor and I preferred the performance setting. And that's after playing 3/4 of the game in resolution where it looked impeccable, looked great. But for me, performance mode, the extra frames was worth it for whatever apparent loss in visual fidelity was there, because the movement's just so much smoother. Reaction times in combat are so much better. Traversal is just so much better. So they did some interesting things there, and from that perspective, it's pretty much surprisingly well polished.
Yeah, I mean, the game does get challenging. There's no doubt about it. Like Rishi mentioned about this beast called a Tide Ripper, and I remember speaking to Rishi. Yesterday or day before yesterday, and I had a lot of trouble in that boss fight because I didn't have any healing items, and like I almost ran out. I mean, I had two of them, but then I figured out how to, you know, like basically I cheesed it. Like I hid behind rocks and did whatever I could do to defend myself. But then I took your advice on the overshield bit, because particularly towards the end of the game, things get really tough. Especially if you're playing in higher difficulties, and having that overshield is a lifesaver. Especially with when you go against big beasts, it's a lifesaver. And I think when I write a guide about this, my beginner tips would be invest in overshield, because it really does help. But overall, I mean I kind of agree with Rishi about the gameplay bit. Apart from a few things that I found a little troublesome. Not really troublesome, I would say. I'm just being finicky here, because that's just me. Like, for example, the game has a lot of focus on stealth, right? And I spoke to Rishi about this before we started recording. If you remember the first game, you have the option to take down the smaller machines, at least, in a single strike, especially when you are hiding in bushes and stuff. The problem is, in this game, I think it was in the previous game as well, but for example, you can only do that when there's a prompt, right? And in stealth games, for example, if you look at Metal Gear Solid or even the early Assassin's Creed games, you always need to have that option so that to silently take down something freely and don't have a prompt to do it. Because if that prompt would go away and I still press the button, it would do a normal attack. And then, of course, I get my ass handed to me by all the machines because it wasn't a silent takedown. So little things like these bothered me a little bit, but it never hindered my progress. It just made things a little more difficult, especially in intense moments. And even in side missions, by the way, it's not like it's these side missions are just things to do. They get intense as well. Oh God, they do. And but yeah, I mean, this is just me nitpicking things. I mean, taking down machines never gets old in this. I remember profusely that my hands were sweaty tackling a lot of the beasts, because it does get intense, especially when you're going up multiple of them. And but yeah, it's a great experience, to be honest. Overall,
I think I do agree with you that some of the stealth aspects could be more polished, but I do think that a lot of it also has to do with your pre-prep before getting into an area. So especially if you're, like, let's say, taking down a rebel camp, or if you want to, you know, take down a herd of enemies, you'll need to make sure you scan everything and then go in for the kill. If you don't, it's going to be problematic. And that's what I realized, at least while sorting out a few of the... Like, I did one or two early side quests, and what I ended up doing was I just didn't want to raise the alarm in those camps. So I spent, like, a good half an hour surveying the entire area, surveying everything around, quietly went in, quietly did every stealth kill, waited, was super patient, played it like a 90s, like, basically MGS1. I played it like MGS1. And I got by just fine. I think, but see, here's the thing, right? The way I look at it is, I have a feeling they've tuned this from a perspective of not of still allowing you to progress regardless of it. And
yeah.
there are so many ways you can get by in terms of XP, right? Or in terms of progression.
Exactly.
You don't really have to. I mean, the stealth aspect is one way. The other way is hitting armor off.
You can go guns blazing.
Yeah.
I mean, arrow blazing.
Yeah, you can do that too. And it's not like you're going to be penalized for either. There aren't any forced stealth sections in the game per se. Maybe just one which is, well, I mean, let's just say if you know where to go on the map, you'll be fine. It's not even a stealth section. I wouldn't even consider it a stealth section because it's essentially underwater. But it's pretty chill from that perspective. Progression happens all the same. But what I would recommend for a better experience is do not, and I cannot stress this enough, do not use the default UI option. If you use the default UI option, you'll be looking at a game that's more, that's basically Assassin's Creed Unity levels of clutter. You will want to, there is an option that in the settings that lets you go with only shows you the critical stuff. And you can.
That's what I did.
Yeah, it's essentially a cool responsive option where if you press down the right trigger, press down R3, you'll see the stuff in your area that you can collect. Otherwise, you can just shows you the most critical things. I would recommend going with that option in your settings. Do not go with default UI because it's triggering in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And aside from that. I mean, yeah, coming back to your point about not having enough health, I mean, to be honest, I never had that problem. That's because I just would pick everything up.
This was in a case where it was not in the overworld. Installation.
I know the area you're referring to. There is a way around it.
There is a way around it. I was just stupid enough not to do it. That's what I was saying.
So essentially for that specific area, and in fact for a lot of the game, I really appreciate the fact that even though the game directive is, oh, you need to rush and save the world, when you go into these areas, you get rewarded for exploration. And in that area in specific, if you actually spent your time and explored, you would find a lot of healing items, which is what I ended up doing.
Yeah. No, I had like 400, 500 in my stash, which I would like just go, like, whenever I see it. Here's what I love. If you collect stuff and you're... inventory is full, all the extra stuff goes to your stash. I love that. I'm like, okay, I can go to a settlement or a camp nearby, whichever has my access to my stash, and I can just restock myself whenever I want. I love that. I really did.
Yeah, that was there in the first game, and they kind of brought it back in a way that kind of matters.
Yeah.
And even for those of you who are wondering about the fast travel packs, yes, they're back. So, yeah.
But... they're Guerrilla Games in the it's a massive open world, but they've placed so many campsites where you can actually, you're not too far away from it for the free fast travel bit. That it doesn't really matter. I would only use it when I would actually get lazy. I have actually 14 of them on me right now. And I would only use it when I'm like really sleepy. Like if I'm playing at 3 a.m. and I just need to save my game. So I would use it then. Otherwise, I would just travel to a nearby camp on a mount and just get there. But I want to talk about something. You mentioned something and I remembered doing something in the game. It has to do with the glider, actually. In fact, the glider changes a lot of things for me in this game. But I want to share one experience. I'm going to try to keep this as spoiler-free as possible. So, there's a particular beast that I needed to take down. And that beast would sit atop a mountain. That's all I'm going to say. And the reason why I needed to take that beast down was because I needed a part from that beast for an armor piece that I wanted to buy. And there were multiples of them. So I took down one. Of course, it was not a silent strike because the same thing happened with me where I accidentally did a normal attack. But I took down one, quickly grabbed the piece that I needed, and I just jumped off the mountain. I'm like, fuck this, I'm not dealing with all of these guys. opened the glider, I just, glided away to safety. And I was like, whoa, at that moment I realized, okay, this is a game changer for me because in the previous game, I would have to deal with these people just for that one part. But now I don't need to, I can just jump off and get away. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it allows you more options for play. And in a way, it also allows you to access or get around certain areas that you may not be able to. Because, fall damage is here also. So, because there's fall damage as well, you can essentially scale a really cool peak, grab what you need to, and do a quick exfil in a way. And I think that works largely well to the game's advantage. because even the terrain you're up against, it's a new area, right? You're not stuck in Meridian. You don't have...
And you get it fairly early as well. So it's not like you have to like play half of the game and then get it.
Yep. So the good thing is that they front-loaded all the cool stuff you need to get your exploration on. And I do agree with you with fast travel being, you know, your get out of jail when you're really tired, because I used it in the same way. Though, yeah. And I'll tell you how careful I've been with using it. I picked up 10 at the very start of the game. Just, you know, because based on the of how I played the last game.
Previous game, yeah.
I had like, yeah. I think I, by the time I finished the last game, I went through 50 of them. So, here I picked up 10, and by the end of the game, I think I only used 2. Because I was, because I was more than happy to either A, make a beeline directly for my next, to the next area, or I was more than happy just to explore the area around and see what's there. Because a lot of the lore, this game has best in class logs. I am yet to see, I mean, probably outside of the Deus Ex series, I'm yet to see a game with better logs. Or maybe Bioshock and Deus Ex. Yeah, aside from those two, I can't even think of a game that has better logs than this one. And they do justice. They really do justice to the world. They really do justice to the story. And the best part is, if you're not the sort who cares about reading TLDR or even listening to what it is, you still can get the context in the cutscenes and everything else. But for those of us who really want more out of it, they're super rewarding. Yeah. And I also like the fact that it's not done in a way like, let's say, another game, Prey, for example. Prey holds one of the game's most critical story elements in an audio log which you could miss. Audio or a written log which you could miss. And here, at least they have done it in such a way where the balance is right. You don't feel like you've lost out if you haven't read any of the logs or heard them. You will still be able to understand the game, get at least a good experience on it. So the way they've distributed story, the way they've brought story in a way that works on several levels is pretty damn good.
So far we've really praised this game, but I did have some other issues, especially in the performance bit. Not that this game performs bad at all, it actually performs really, really well. But little things that I came across, like Rishi mentioned, it works great in 60 FPS. That's what I played in performance mode as well. But there were some issues that I found, like, you know, slight lighting issues. Like I would be standing in a spot, especially in the beginning of the game, and I would just pan the camera and the light would keep switching as if, you know, I'm standing under a tube light. But I think that has been patched. I have to say that when I experienced that was before the patch. There was a recent patch that was released just a few days ago.
I think it's the day one patch, roughly 1.8 gigabytes. It did fix, for me at least, it fixed a couple of loading issues. So and that's something that they said they would fix anyway. So that's there. I had one or two issues as well, but mainly had to do with me getting stuck in geometry of the game early on. But when I went and checked out the game before this podcast to see if I could replicate it, that wasn't the case. Everything seemed fine. So
the only major bug that I came across, and again, this may have been patched out, was like when I would loot a chest, this happened 3 times to me, basically. And Aloy would be stuck in an infinite loop animation, basically. So you couldn't get out of it. You couldn't cancel it, nothing. So I would have to like reload my save, which is not that bad because it would just save. There was some autosave that happened like literally a minute ago. But this happened 3 times to me. But I have a feeling that would have been patched as well. Apart from that, I didn't face any major bugs like that, any game-breaking bugs in a way, to be honest. Overall, this is probably one of the best open-world games that will launch probably in a while.
I got to agree with you. And a lot of it also has to do with the fact that this is a game world that's still fresh. If this was something like, you know, for a bad example, but Assassin's Creed or Far Cry, where you know what to expect multiple entries in, it gets a little stale after a while. And you know, that's why exactly they had to do Ragnarok Valhalla and Odyssey for that reason. Yeah. So here, the really good thing is that personally, I really liked Zero Dawn because it had that sense of mystery to the game world. And that is something I'm very shocked that Guerrilla has been able to maintain, and shocked in a good
way. I'm like, what's happening here? Oh, this is happening. No, this is not what's happening. Like, there, you're always questioning yourself and the story and everything else that is happening in the game. And you never know the answer to any of it.
Yeah, I mean, you do towards the end, but...
that's towards the end.
But honestly, yeah, it's really rewarding from a point of view if you're looking at story. And I think that's something I feel most open world games, I mean, outside of The Witcher 3, tend to miss.
Yeah.
Actually, also Witcher 2 to that degree. And I feel that that's something that they've done really well here. The lore is well done. It fits. It all fits in a nice way.
And it's paced really well.
Yep.
That's what I love the most. Like, it's not like they bombard you with information all of a sudden. No, it's, you know, they give you information as you progress through the story, and it's all relevant information. It gives you an opportunity to think that, okay, what is this for? Okay, so what's going to happen later on? You know, it gets you thinking, and that's what a story or any kind of narrative should be about. Like, it needs to question, like, you should question what's happening to get answers, and that motivates you to play the game even more and even more. And that's why I didn't even notice where my 32 hours went, because I was just like, yeah, I'm having fun. I'm intrigued. That's what I loved.
Yep. Agree completely. Though there were a couple of things I felt that they could have done better, and they're spoiler-related territory, so I'm not going to get into them. But suffice to say, if you thought Guerrilla did a good job with Zero Dawn, you're going to like what they've done here. And
you're going to love what you did here. At least that's what I think.
And more importantly, I think it's interesting also from an industry standpoint, right? Because as usual, you have the usual set of suspects doing the whole games as a service, doing the whole NFTs in games, doing the whole crypto, blockchain, Web3 stuff in games. It's nice to see that we still have developers and studios and publishers that actually think about it as art and think about it as actually put, you know, such a good emphasis on building up something you really want to play as, you know, entertainment and recreation. So from an industry perspective, I think this is also... I think it's come at a critical time, particularly when you look at where the business is going. So, yeah. And from an India perspective, it's going to be fun to see what the reception's like. And I say this because Zero Dawn did extremely well in India. It sold around 6,000 to 7,000 units, if I count grey market sales as well, by my estimates.
Yeah.
And it came at a time when the PS4 install base was roughly 60,000. So... it's safe to assume what 10% of all PS4 owners in India bought Zero Dawn. I wouldn't be surprised if Forbidden West will do at least double of that, in my estimate. There is hype. People care. The number of people who have asked me about the Regala and Collector's Editions is insane at this point. It's
Me being one of them.
Yeah, so there's like a lot of hype around this. There's a lot of interest around this. And I think it's a good sign because if I look at the digital version with a 97 gig download, the physical copies will hold their own and do well because of that. And mainly also because there are some really cool things at retail happening with this. There's a sticker set and decal set they're doing for exclusive as for to offline stores. They're doing the steelbook variants as well, which pre-orders happened.
Almost sold out.
Yeah, pretty much done very well there. And they've even done some good stuff with the collectors in Regala that, fingers crossed, hopefully by the time this podcast goes up, either should be available for pre-order or should be available on the day. So we'll have to see when that happens, according to my sources. But yeah, Sony's brought their A-game to this. They've even gone to the extent of dressing up stores in places like Nagpur, of all places, you know, where they want to make sure that the game's well represented at stores, it's well represented online. They're bringing their A-game with this one. And I think it's nice to see, because if you look at the competition, Microsoft's doing nothing of value. It's great to see someone doing something, particularly around tentpole titles. I mean,
it shows they're invested in the market.
And
that's what matters towards the end. That's how you garner loyal customers, right?
Agreed.
I mean, it's marketing 101. But the fact that you're actually doing marketing 101 matters more than what actually the competition is not even trying to do.
I mean, yeah, and as a long-suffering Halo fanboy, I'm just sad that we got nothing on Infinite. Yeah. I mean, not even...
Let's not talk about that.
Apparently, the best thing apparently I heard was that when retailers got their stock of Infinite, of Halo Infinite, only that time did they get posters. And I'm like, dude, you guys could have done that months ahead. You guys could have done something. But retailers...
We didn't even get a steelbook for that.
Yeah.
I'm so upset.
Yeah, India didn't even get the steelbook for that. I mean, sure, I get it. Game Pass and all that's the future and all. Cool story, bro. But there's an audience that actually wants steelbooks. And if they can do it in US and UK and Europe, why the hell not for India?
And Japan.
Yeah, and Japan too. Why the hell not for India? I mean, what? It's just like, you launch the console and that's it. Now then we're second class citizens for the rest of the generation. So, yeah, I mean...
But I do want to point out that we're actually recording at a very opportune moment now that we're talking about sales figures and stuff. Sony just announced yesterday that Horizon Zero Dawn sold 20 million units on the PS4, PS5... Well, on the PS4 and PC combined. And from what I'm hearing, that Forbidden West is expected to sell, well, at least this was last week, 15 million lifetime sales. But now that's not true because of seeing what Zero Dawn did. I think it can go beyond that as well. And I'm really interested how big this game will be in India. Like, I have feelers, but that's all we can get at the moment.
Honestly, my concern is how they define lifetime. If their definition of lifetime is 5 year sales, when you assume 2016 and you assume the recording period, five and a half year sales, I think 20 plus is doable. See, here's something.
That's what they mean.
Here's the thing. So what some people tend to forget is while I did say Zero Dawn sold 6,000 to 7,000 on month one, it sold much more over the lifetime because the complete edition price was close to 1,000 rupees.
And it would go down to 600, 700 on sale.
Yeah, and if you bought it used, you're paying 350. So, way I see it...
And keep in mind, if you're a PS Plus subscriber, Sony gave this game away for free
exactly.
as well. Yet it sold.
So, and right now even, I mean, I know people who've gone and bought the complete edition now of Zero Dawn and to play on PS5, mind you. So... My point is, I do see a situation where the India number would be a lot higher. And I'll tell you why. Because if I go by what happened with towards the end of the PS4's life cycle, or actually to the middle, actually, of the PS4's life cycle, with games like Spider-Man and God of War, both of them hit the 50,000 mark of sales within 3 months. I would assume over the lifetime, Zero Dawn, and if we go by, so my estimate is we probably have 550k PS4s now. Zero Dawn would have easily sold probably 100k, 150k. 100, easy. 150 if not games. Sold, yeah. If not sold, at least people, that's the number of people who've played it. Right? At the bare minimum.
Maybe potentially even more if you keep the used market in mind.
I don't know. I don't know. With the used market, that's a tricky one because, to be honest, it's a lot more nebulous when I consider that a lot of used game trades tend to be more informal these days, between friends at places like OLX, Quicker Types. You do have sites like Game Loot and CEX, but I don't know how large their volumes are. But I would say, given all considered, everything considered and how this game has been accessible, right, Zero Dawn in particular, I do believe that it would have easily surpassed Spider-Man and God of War in terms of people who have played it, at least. Maybe not sales, but at least people who have played it and accessed it in one way or another. So, yeah.
So far, we've spoken about the game, almost every aspect of the game. If you had to give it a rating, what rating would you give this game?
Man, that's a tough one.
Out of a scale of 10, because that gives you more margin.
Honestly, I'm like thinking between 8.5 and 9. And
yeah, I'm around the same. I may even go 9.5 if I have to.
And the reason why 8.5, 9 and not like 11 or 10 on 10 is simply because of... So here's the thing, all right? Let me explain to you where I'm coming from. I am deeply invested in this universe. All right. Forbidden West, I did another playthrough of Zero Dawn. I think I finished Zero Dawn like two and a half times at this point. I've gone through logs on the first game. I loved every bit of it. I really liked the way they set up, and to me the most touching thing is what happened to the Alpha Primes, what Ted Farrow was doing, and all the cool stuff in the first game. How the old ones tried to save the world. you know, I really like that narrative, and I really like the whole exploratory element of the first game. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And they do a lot of it well here, except for one thing which I can't talk about. But aside from that, to me, look, I play these games for story. I'm not going to like, yeah. I mean, I play these games for story. I play stuff like Dishonored, Prey, and Deathloop for gameplay. And I play stuff like Monster Hunter with my friends because co-op is fun. And I play Halo, yeah. And I play Halo for all of these things. But fact of the matter is, from a story perspective, they've done justice 90% of the way. But that 10% they didn't get still keeps me up at night wondering, you know, why. It's not a major thing. It's just me being nitpicky because I'm so invested in the story. It's like super nitpicky of me because I'm like, you know, how could you types? But I understand why and how and all that. It's just that that's the only reason why I would go 8.5, 9. Just for that, because, like, come on, man. I've been like, so after finishing Zero Dawn for the first time, and, you know, that ending was of Zero Dawn was essentially sequel bait, and they do justice to most of it. It's just that, bro, do you even? So, 8.5, 9 from my perspective, and that's just because, I mean, literally I'm at that point where if you cut me, I'll bleed arrows at this point. So, yeah. and shards.
I would put it around between 9 and 9.5 because I really loved the game. Even the technical stuff that were bothersome, well, not bothersome, as I said, small glitches weren't really that big of a problem to me. But what you said just now, right? I actually see it in a positive way. The fact that the game makes you worry about the small things and nitpicking things says to me that don't worry about the major plot because that's fucking sorted. Right? Like, the fact that it's making you go worry about the minutiae of the narrative, and I love that. Simply because, let's say if it's a game that the main plot itself is a problem or it has many issues with it, then you don't even bother with the small things that bother you, right? But the fact that you are now concerned more about the small things rather than the main overall overarching story, I love that. I take it as a positive way that, yeah, what Rishi is worried about might be addressed later on in a DLC or something. But overall, the story is, the payoff is great. It's satisfying. It's badass in some cases. So I really loved the story in that sense.
And if you're the sort who likes political intrigue, there is a lot of it. The fact, the way it introduces you to some of the clans, the way the tribes, the way it introduces you and makes you feel invested in their own success or lack thereof is really, really, really cool. It's good stuff all around, man. I mean, GG Gorilla, GG.
I have to give a special mention to the soundtrack, though. Like, I loved the music in this game. There were times I felt as if I was in Jurassic Park, thanks to the soundtrack. I mean, of course, the machines are there. You got that feeling from the first game as well. But then there were times I felt like I was in Lion King when I was just exploring the world and, you know, with sunsets and, you know, at the back of my, you know, at the back, or when you're going to the snow, you know, snow-capped mountains and stuff. The music overall, even the background score, it's a mix of electronic, it's a mix of intense music. That's what I call it sometimes when I am, you know, battling bosses. But overall, even the sound design, like the 3D audio bit was just so much fun and so much it offered so much immersion that I still can't get. I think it's the best implementation I've seen on the PS5, at least, for their audio technology. I really loved that experience. I really loved it. I think the audio made it for me.
Oh, yeah, I do agree. And actually, it's good you bring that up because that totally slipped my mind, because there's so much else about this which I was thinking of, was that even the DualSense implementation is pretty good. It's not Ratchet and Clank levels of showing off how good the system can be, but it's done in a subtle way that matters. So the resistance when you pull a bow, the resistance when you use the bolt caster, even the way the microphone works, the haptics in general are very fine-tuned and extremely well done. But if you're expecting something of Ratchet and Clank levels of, hey, you know, this is going to be wild with every weapon, don't expect that.
Yeah.
But it's done well.
Don't expect that. And I like that. I like that because there's so many weapons in this game that you can't possibly, and you have to use almost all of them in some battle or the other, that you can't be bothered to remember, oh, yeah, this is the amount of resistance that I have to deal with. And even in things like when you are riding a mount, like when you're riding the machine, the charger, you can feel that friction in the controller. Now, granted that there's great DualSense implementation, but what I noticed was that due to these haptics and due to these customizations and vibrations and whatnot, your DualSense batteries doesn't last as long as it does in other games.
Oh yeah, so be prepared Could you bring that up? Because I actually had a note of this somewhere. I went through. So I have two PS5 controllers. Both of them are essentially charged and good to go whenever. I ran through. Yeah. I think one and a half, two entire charges of each while playing this. So yeah, you're right. It won't last. So
and one small tip: if you're playing on the PS5, if the console says that your controller's battery is low, don't worry about it. It actually will go on for another 2 hours. Trust me on that.
Yeah, but you don't want to hit that limit all the time because your battery over a long term will suffer.
Just don't, like what I'm trying to say, like panic about it. Like you can play it for half an hour extra and then put it in charging. But yeah, overall, I think the DualSense implementation is exactly what I expected, not too overboard also. And they didn't ignore it either. Did you play the game on the PS4 though?
My PS4 is with a friend, so I've given that to him for a while. So no, I haven't played it on PS4, and I don't know anyone who's reviewing it who's playing it on PS4 either. So that's a scene over there. But I would suspect that looking at how a lot of late gen PS4 games have run, and given Sony's focus on optimization, it wouldn't be that bad an experience, though there will be loading times galore, so that's something to keep in mind. But aside from that, I mean, if you're on last gen, you should be okay until you find a PS5 and can up.
Well, speaking of loading, on the PS5, it's a breeze. Like, thankfully, they have that manual prompt because, like, let's say you fast travel or somewhere, like, they have a title screen, but that title screen is just there by default, just so that to give you some tips and so that you can press X to, you know, start playing the game again. But the loading times are incredible in this, on the PS5 at least. I was shocked at that.
Though they may change in the final build because they, I don't know how the day one patch would impact some aspects of that. So they might just even be better.
Yeah, it could be even better. Yeah. But I think we haven't touched the story, to be honest, a lot. And that's for a reason. There are a lot of things in this game that you would want to experience in the first hand. I'm not comfortable talking about it because I know how Horizon fans can be. But Rishi, if you want to talk about it a little bit,
I mean, please feel. To be honest, it's a good
story. You don't really need
all to. All I'm saying is that it's a good story. Check it out. If you like the first game, there's a good payoff. This is a studio that knows how to respect its fans. So
I would say it's one of the best sci-fi games in the past decade. I would say that one of the best, not the best, one of the best.
It's
sci-fi stories.
It's close. Yeah.
So people who want to buy this game can get it on the 18th of February. I think it costs $5,000 on the PS5, $4,000 on the PS4, and if you're smart, you would get the PS4 version and save that extra $1,000 because you've got a free upgrade as well.
I don't know how much you'll really save. If you're buying the PS4 version and if you have a PS5, I really don't know how much you'll actually save, because when you count the fact that unless you have a fast internet connection to download that 98 odd gigabytes, it's kind of, in my opinion, not exactly the smartest thing to do, I feel, at least. And at least early signs at retail seem to suggest that customers are thinking the same way, because a lot of retail is super confident on pushing the PS5 version easy. PS4 is where the problems tend to be because end of life.
Yeah.
But we'll have to see how it goes, because knowing Sony and how Sony will want to treat this, my suspicion is Sony will make sure the quantity of PS4 and PS5 version of the games is the same. What this means for you is if you haven't been able to find the PS5 version, or you know, you'll still be okay. The dual entitlement system works just fine. So that's just something to keep in mind if you're not going to be on a day and date for whatever reason. Down the line, you still should be taken care of. This is not a game that's going to sell out by any stretch of imagination. So, and that's also part of the reason why we talk sales to some degree, because end users should know, right, that it's not a situation where you have to buy day one.
It won't be like the Ghost of Tsushima situation where the game went out of stock the first week and people couldn't find
it. Oh, yeah, there's a reason for that. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that Sony assumed it would be like, Sony India assumed it would sell like Neo 2 without actually knowing the game's quality and gameplay and how Indians react and play the games. And that's an error that happens when you have a newer team. Though, full credit to Sony, that team has become a lot more competent since then. And that's something
they replenished the stocks right away.
Oh yeah,
like, when they saw the way market responded, they were like, get more shit right now, because the people who want to buy the physical copy,
oh yeah,
and we don't have the
agreed
the stock.
Fair credit to the team, they know what they're doing, they're able to react well enough. So I'm not too worried on availability for this one at all. I think there is going to be supply. You won't have a problem walking into a store or ordering it and getting it. And it's going to be a good one.
Speaking of availability, and I like to talk to you about this every single time because you seem to have all the info on this most of the times, unless you're on a holiday. But since this game is coming out on the PS5 and the PS4, there will be people who would want to buy a PS5 with the game as well, or they want to like probably experience this. They want this to be the first game they experience on the PS5. So when can people get their hands on the PS5 again? When is the next restock?
Oh, that.
And,
I can't believe we're in 2022 and people are still asking me this. And I can't blame anyone at all because...
You can't blame anyone.
Because the queries for this in particular have been coming in thick and fast in the last week or so. Now, there was a rumor of a Monday announce, but I haven't heard anything, at least at the time of recording, I haven't heard anything yet from my sources. But what I will say is, it makes sense for Sony to restock and have a PS5 and have the PS5 for sale on or around Horizon Forbidden West release. And here's why I say this is because you don't want your potentially biggest title of the year to be available, and you don't want your customers, your community, or even the supply chain to say stuff like, oh, you have your game, but where's the hardware? And that's something they know. That's something Sony understands. It helped with Ratchet and Clank, you know, where it was available around the same time. So I think we're going to get one in February. It's just a question of when the announcement happens. It could happen by the time this recording is out. It could happen a week after. So I wouldn't worry on that. I think it will happen. It's just a question of when. What I will say, though, is the quantities I'm hearing of are going to be on the smaller side. And that's also has to do with general supply chain issues that Sony has to deal with the chip shortage, among other things. So I wouldn't... I wouldn't worry about a restock. Because a restock will be announced. I would worry about getting one when the restock is announced, because I do feel the quantities will be on the smaller side. And here's the thing, right? If I go by sales figures and by my estimates on the market, if we go with the assumption that there are 60,000 PS5s in the wild in India, that's what the PS4 was in 2 years. So the situation is then, is there more of an audience, or has Sony already saturated the market? Now, from whoever I've been speaking to, now there's more demand in tier two. Pune, Nagpur, Raipur.
A lot.
There's more demand there than there is in tier one cities at this juncture. So the question is, can it sustain? Or is it just a flash in the pan? And I think it'll be interesting to see how that works out, because if you look at it, even the import stickers on the last restock, they were September, which means no units have been coming in, or it means Sony stockpiling. I'm likely to believe units haven't come in. Sony isn't the kind to, I mean, they'll ration out stock, yes, but I don't think they'll stockpile. I don't think someone at Sony sitting on like, you know, an odd 1,000, 2,000 PS5s, just keeping it there, you know, for hoarding it. They're not that kind of company.
They want to get these out as fast as possible as well, I guess.
Yeah, because inventory is death. There are costs attached. Yeah? You can't have stuff lying in the warehouse without good
There's
reason.
There's rent to pay.
Yeah, so I don't see a situation where, the only reason I can think for them rationing it out is because they haven't got new stock yet. But we'll see with the next restock. I'm expecting February this month.
Do you think Forbidden West will be bundled with the console though?
No, I don't think so, because unless there's a bundle internationally, I don't see India doing it. That's one part of it. Second part of it, even when there have been bundles internationally, like with Ratchet and Clank, those bundles were not sanctioned here. Or they didn't happen here. Simple as that.
Yeah.
So I do see retailers telling customers, hey, if you want this, we can also give you this. I do see that happening. But I don't see proper bundling coming in for this from Sony. Not right now, at least.
I wish you knew how many Regala and Collector's Editions are coming, because I am kind of scared.
My suspicion on that is that we're looking at low double digits or single digits for those two. And why I say that is because most of the demand for this will mainly be on Standard and Steelbook. It doesn't make much sense to bring a lot of this in. And
but what happens is, like, when you have single digits or low double digits, right, that's like still not enough for the kind of people. Like, I know at least four people who want to buy the Regala edition. Like, they don't want to get anything else. That's just four of us. You probably know eight.
No, so, I actually know 20 at this point. But
so that's high 20.
But here's the thing. These 20 people are the kind of people who can easily import it if they want to. They're just being lazy. Generally speaking,
yeah, because it saves you customs, it saves you extra delivery charge, saves you a little bit of money.
I get that. But then fact of the matter is, look, these, like, we're rarefied air compared to the rest of the gaming audience in terms of spend. So if you look at the greater market, and if you look at what's good for the market and what's good for the audience, it makes sense to bring this in to give people an aspirational value that, hey, this is cool stuff I should pick up when I have the money. That's one part of it, which is why it's necessary. It's strategically important to bring these in. But if I look at return on investment in the short term and what people are buying in the short term, it's going to be the Steelbook variant and it's going to be Standard.
Yeah.
But I do agree that you need some of this in to show people that, hey, you know, this is cool stuff. This is stuff I should aspire to buy. And I say that as someone who spent a large chunk of my first year's salary on just collecting all the PS2 games I couldn't afford to buy when I was starting out, when I was a student.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I've been doing for the past 3-4 months. I've been rebuying my 360 and PS3 physical collection that I had, because I was a college student, didn't have money. I sold it off because I had to get the PS4. So, you know, like, I guess I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
But for example, the Regal edition, the moment it was announced, I was like, yeah, I've got to save money for this. Took me a year to, you know, just get where I am so that I can afford it. And now it's the question, like, will I even get the chance to pay money for it?
I think you will. See,
hopefully. I have been bugging retailers everywhere. I'm like, listen, you get to know something, shit, call me right away.
See, I can't blame retail for also being a little cautious on this, right? Because if you look what happened...
Yeah, you can't.
I'll tell you why. Because with Last of Us Part 2, what went down was a lot of people... I mean, there was an excess in terms of the collector's edition, which no one ended up buying. And that's something you don't want, right? As a publisher, as a retailer, no one wants that. So... with this time around, people are, I mean, the retail and Sony are going to be a little cautious. You can't blame them for having that.
I don't.
And I'll tell you why, because the last time that much glut happened in the market on a version of the game was with Killzone 3, with the Hellgast edition of Killzone 3, which was still lying on the shelves 3 months after launch. Now, that's a bad look for everyone involved. And we're talking huge quantities here. So, I think stores like Landmark, which had like prime real estate in Mumbai at the time, Landmark at Lower Parel, they were sitting on like 3 units that were just there. And it's a bad impression, right? And I think overall, they were like, in the market, they were like easily like 300, 400 units that were just lying all over the place that no one picked up because the quantities were so ridiculously high. So, and there is an appetite to a point, right? So, I think that's something Sony's been careful to avoid ever since.
By the way, I don't know if you saw your text message before we hopped onto this call. Did you see the picture I sent you of the collector's edition? Do you see how big it is?
Yeah, I did. And I'm like, thank God I'm buying the Steelbook version. Simple as that.
It is a chonky boy.
Yeah.
Like, it is.
So,
it's as big as the PS5 probably, or maybe bigger. I don't know.
Yeah, so I'm not. That's why I'm very happy buying the Steelbook variant. I'm not breaking my head on this. So
yeah,
simple as that.
I have to break my head over it. I'm like, fuck it, I need it. But it looks pretty as hell. It looks really nice. But let's see. I hope luck is there. But yeah, I think we've touched upon probably every aspect of this game. We've given it. I gave a rating, you gave a rating. We talked about what we love, what we didn't like. Well, not really not like, but things that we kind of like know will be improved. But yeah, I mean, if you own a PlayStation 5, if you like RPGs that respect your time, that has a good payoff in the story as well, I would be like, get this game you know, whenever you feel comfortable. I'm not going to say get it on launch. Not everyone can do that. But if you can, get it on launch.
Pretty much, I would agree. Right? I would agree.
Yeah. So, but yeah, thank you, Rishi, for giving us a lowdown about the game, what you've thought about the game, about the sales figures, and about those 20 people who are probably itching for more information on the collector's edition.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are a different kind of crazy, man. I used to be in that boat, and I am glad I am off that boat. But yeah.
Yeah, so, but yeah, play this game. Let us know what you think about the game when you finish it. You can always look out for Rishi. Rishi, where can people find you and converse with you?
So I'm on Twitter at Rishi Alwani, A-L-W-A-N-I, and I have a weekly newsletter called 0451games.substack.com, where I usually put stuff out on the games business, particularly from, as you would have guessed, the business perspective of it with the sales and other stuff. And that.
Yep, and you can find me at Bhallanator on Twitter, and you can tweet at me about your thoughts, if you agree or disagree. If you disagree, please share your opinions, because that's the kind of conversation I love to have, because I get to learn more things. And and we will see you probably at launch of Horizon. Do share your photo mode pictures as well. I know Rishi will be doing that.
Yeah, like expect spam on the day. It's just going to be that kind of thing. Yeah, I totally forgot to say, yeah, the photo mode is best in class. Nothing else to say on that. But yeah.
Yeah. I had issues with the photo mode, but then the patch fixed it completely for me. So yeah, now I'm going apeshit crazy. I'm like, should I take this picture for the review? Should I take this for the something of that, for the cover art? I'm like, yeah, let's just chill for a moment. But yeah, enjoy. And so we'll see you on the next episode of the Untitled Gadget Podcast. And thank you, Rishi, for your time. And thank you for everyone else for listening to this podcast before the launch of the game. And I'm excited to see everyone's reaction to the story. So yeah, let's see it.